Radio MD.
RadioMD.com.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Here's Dr. Michael Roizen.
And this is Dr. Mike. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, is the passionate show that helps you take control of your health by providing you with the information you need to live at the top of your curve for very long. You know, if you look, this is podcast, by the way, 800. We're 8/13/16. That is August 13th, 2016 podcast for the second hour of You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. If you look back to 2001, probably I think it was about show six, podcast number six, if you will. I don't know. They don't have listed by that, but they do have listed by the date. If you go on RadioMD.com, you can get the archives of all our shows. You go way back to one of the original shows. We said that the following were the exercises you needed for living the longest. That is what we called doing the minimum work for maximum health benefit. So we said that was the real age workout. It was 10,000 steps a day, plus 30 minutes of resistance exercise a week, plus 20 minutes at a 80% or greater of your maximum heart rate, your cardio, 20 minutes three times a week. Well, you add those all up, and it's about 85 minutes a week of exercise. Turns out we added one to it last year, that is 20 jumps every morning and 20 jumps every evening for strengthening your hip and spine bones. Well, when you look at all of those, the World Health Organization came out, this is 15 years later than we did, maybe 16 years later, and said, guess what? The minimum you need to have maximum benefit in preventing heart disease and cancer was 80 minutes a week. So it's almost exactly, that is, that exact duplicate. They were able to replicate the data. So, of course, the reason it's the same is that we use the data. We just got it a little earlier, did it a little faster than they did to show what the data were, and that's what it is. There are four components of exercise. Any, which is the walking equivalent of about 70 minutes a week, 10,000 steps each day for 7 days. Add to it 20 minutes three times a week or an hour of cardio. Add to it 30 minutes of resistance exercise, and then those 20 jumps morning and evening for your bones that are new this year or last year, and you've got the maximum, and the World Health Organization has confirmed that's exactly right. Now you say, well, Olympians do a lot more. Do they get more health benefit? No, that's right. This is the minimum you can do for maximum health benefit. And you say, well, the Olympians are in much better shape. Yes, they're chiseled in much better shape, and they get a fitness benefit and a competitive benefit by doing more, but they don't get a health benefit. In fact, the data were sent out a couple years ago by a wonderful study showing that Olympians had a much greater risk of atrial fibrillation, that abnormal heartbeat, and that increased their risk of sudden death and of abnormal, if you will, heartbeats and even of clots in their atrium from atrial fibrillation. Those were increased dramatically by the increased exercise that Olympians do. A great increase, about a 300% increase. That is three times as much as the average person did. So this year, right at this time, there was another study saying, of course, with the Rio Olympics, we're asking the same question, but in a little more sophisticated way. So if they don't get more arrhythmias, do they live longer? Do they have more heart problems? And so they looked at this study in 33 former Olympians who were still active, but not to the same degree. And what they found is their heart size and other things regressed as they became less competitive, and they had less of the, if you will, abnormal heart rate and propensity to atrial fibrillation. So you can recover from this. Your heart gets to what we call remodel over time. And so that's the big news, if you will. Yes, there is a athletic heart syndrome and a risk for overdoing it. But if you cut back after your intensity, you don't keep doing marathons your whole life, but you cut back, then it appears you have normal heart function. Now, there's another thing. There are people who go, if you will, do more, that is the exercise fanatics. They enjoy it. They have fun, so that's a good thing. They have camaraderie. That's a good thing. But they still have a penalty if you do more than 2 hours of exercise in a row without a break. It appears you can do 2 hours, break for an hour, do 2 hours again, and or at least do more. We don't know whether you can do the full 2 hours again without a penalty to yourselves. But what happens is you exceed the free radical buffering capacity, the internal antioxidants. It's not the antioxidants you eat. It's the ones inside your cell. You have SOD, catalase, and glutathione. It appears those get exceeded, and you start to do damage to your mitochondria and increase your frailty if you do more than 2 hours in a row. Now, we're going to have Jim Graham on, coming on pretty soon, and in addition, a expert, Dr. Anish Aseth, on GERD and the Streta procedure, a new procedure since the GERD drugs have all kinds of problems, and we'll go over those. But we're going to have an expert on at the bottom of the hour. So I'm going to do the Real Age Tip of the Week. This is the Real Age Tip for Podcast 400. So if you want to hear it again or get the reference for it, it is one on slow down aging with this dinner choice. And I explained in the past what telomeres are. They're the fragile ends of your DNA, and they do reveal exactly how young or old you are. And here's the dinner choice that can keep them in tip-top shape. Salmon, ocean trout, those are the only two fish in North America with predictable DHA. Flax, chia seeds, canola oil, avocado, and walnuts. In a study, a wonderful study of people who had heart disease who were 50 and over, 60 and over, 70 and over, three groups, they looked at the content of these omega-3, the healthy omega-3s, in your blood and looked at the telomere length. And what happens, telomeres really guard the DNA the way plastic shoelace tips stop your sneaker laces from fraying. But the telomeres grow shorter as part of our natural aging process, your aging process. Stress, body inflammation, a lack of exercise, extra pounds can shorten those tips even faster, essentially opening wider the window to all sorts of body aging damage. We're talking about extra wrinkles, gray hair, brittle bones, even that heart disease and cancer. Well, enter omega-3s, especially DHA and ALA. Scientists suspect that the omega-3s in dinners or lunches or breakfasts or snacks activate the body's defenses against telomere munching free radicals. These healthy omega-3s boost the activity of a telomere pampering enzyme called telomerase, which probably helps explain why the volunteers in that recent study, who all had heart disease and were in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, so dramatically increased telomere length when they had the highest concentration of omega-3s. So during this 5-year study, telomeres shortened 3 times faster in people with the lowest levels of these and lengthened compared to the average in people that have the highest levels of these. So get your omega-3s. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Thank you.
Audible.com.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show with Michael Roizen, MD. Here's Dr. Mike.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on Radio MD, where our goal is to help you stay well. I'm joined now by Jim Graham, who's going to talk to us about some of the environmental issues associated with the news this week that affect your health. So these are important items. Jim, there was a study on if we decrease air pollution just a little bit, we'd be much better off. There's another item on, if you will, on Americans don't have perfect drinking water. 6 million of them have, in fact, toxic chemicals in it. What about the data now on algal blooms? We're hearing about algal blooms.
Yes, Mike. And this is caused by a lot of runoff from the large, I suspect, corporation farms and local farms. And they don't regulate when they're using more nitrates and their animal waste, and it's running off into the creeks and streams. And they're having an awful time in California. The unregulated farm pollution is dirtying all the California water. And I didn't know if you knew this or not, but California produces more than half the nation's fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Nitrogen is an essential for growing these crops. But most of this nitrogen on farms and in the state don't end up where it's supposed to. It ends up in our food, or it ends up in the ground and in the groundwater. And when every year in California, 400,000, think about that, 400,000 tons of nitrogen leach into the California groundwater, with agriculture accounting for 88% of this. And when nitrogen gets into our water supply, it turns into nitrates. And we know what bacon and nitrates and things do to you. And it can cause ovarian, thyroid cancer, and it's all and almost tripled the risk of bladder cancer.
So that's just from the that's just direct, in fact, problem. But there's also a problem, is there not, from what causes these things when they get into the water supply of our local water? It also causes the, and I think you were telling me this, it also causes the growth of these algal blooms like we had in Toledo.
That's right. And it's sneaking up on Cleveland, too. I think you have one out there, too. And that's not the one from the Cuyahoga River. You know, when these organizers blame the green invasion on algae, and now they're blaming it, you know, they thought in Rio, they were blaming the green water in their swimming pool on algae. Now they're blaming it on chemicals. But guess what? Across the country, many lakes, rivers, and lakes have been shuttered as a result of these toxic algae blooms. And what happens, the nitrates get into the water. And it causes
these algae to
grow. What it do, they die, and it shuts off the oxygen supply to the water, and these algae grow in there. I lost my copy. Go ahead, pick it up, Mike. My copy here.
Oh, so Jim, what happens is the algal blooms, if you will, then cause this toxic, if you will, chemical locally. And that toxic chemical, one, can hurt our nerves, but in addition, it deprives the normal flora, the normal healthy flora of flowers and plants, of oxygen. And so they are killed, and so we have more of the algal, if you will, that green bloom. So is that the issue?
I have a question for you. I'll just turn the tables a little bit because I got a little hung up here. In my opinion, I don't think the government is regulating the the flow of these pollutants into our water system. And I think maybe the best thing to do is have the people that are listening call the representatives or members of Congress and maybe put the hammer down on some of these big corporations. I think most of the farmers in this country are doing the right thing. What they're doing is they're shutting the water, or they're making little buffer zones where they can run the water off into a safer area where it's not going to run into your lakes and streams. And also, one of the smart things to do to keep from this happening is good housekeeping. Around your house, you dust and you keep things out of the way. Well, you should do the same thing when you're dealing with these chemicals and things. Keep them in a safe place. Don't farm next to your local stream. There's a lot of water, but rain will produce that water.
Farming near the local stream is a problem, apparently, then.
Yes, it is. It actually is a problem. And one of the main problems is with cattle, you have manure and you have the runoff and everything, stuff like this. And when you're putting pesticides and you're putting all these different things on your garden and you get a rainstorm and it runs off into your creek, what's it going to do? It's getting in the water supply, and that creek goes into a larger body of water, then that into a larger body of water. And what's going to happen then? It's going to seep into the ground, and what do you have? You have pollution. So now you have to put water filters on your faucet so you can have clean
water. Is that an answer? In other words, how good are the carbon filters? Well, it looks like a lot of the perfluoro and a lot of the organic chemicals they take away, but the nitrogen and the algal bloom, a lot of the, what we're taught, the, if you will, neurotoxins put out by the algal blooms, many of them are not filtered by a carbon filter. So you need to put a reverse osmosis filter. So the message we're giving you today is, right now, you can use carbon filters for many of the organic compounds and many of the inorganic compounds that are in water. But if the algal bloom comes, be very careful. You may need to use a reverse osmosis system because those toxins, the neurotoxins from the algal bloom, are not picked up by the common carbon filter. And by the way, the activated carbon filter, those are wonderful for many of the chemicals and medicines that are contaminating our water supply and that are in the unsafe water supply of the 6 million Americans where it's been tested.
One last question. How about, now you're talking about carbon filters, does that include charcoal filters?
Yes, it's the activated charcoal filters are the ones we're talking about. It's a commonly known Brita filter, if you will. So those Brita filters are very effective for some of the organic compounds, like the is in packaging material and the perfluoro compounds. But the perfluoro compounds, if you don't use those, are able to get in the water supply and stay there for long, long periods of time. Those are the flame retardants that now we've gotten in wells. By the way, when we come back from the break, we have another sensational guest. GERD, that is gastroesophageal reflux disease, heartburn, is one of the most common things. We're going to talk about the various treatments and the new treatment, Sprita. And we'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, where we give you the information so that you can take control of your health. You want your friends to hear this, by the way, this interview coming up about GERD and heartburn? Tell them it's podcast 400-813-2016. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
RadioMD.com. It's your life, your health, it's your show. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Dr. Michael Roizen, MD.
And this is Dr. Mike. We have Anisha, S-H-E-T-H, who's a physician, gastroenterologist at the Princeton Medical Group in New Jersey, where it's hotter than heck today. And Dr. Shasta, we're really appreciative of you coming on. He received his bachelor degree from Brown University, his medical degree also from Brown, and then he trained where my son also trained at the Hospital University of Pennsylvania, and was a hospitalist there until he completed his fellowship in gastroenterology at Yale New Haven, and has joined recently the Princeton Medical Group. I guess that's recently as 5 years ago, as a chief gastroenterologist. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, what commonly people have heartburn. We see a guy advertising taking a purple pill for it on TV, who's not a physician. And 50 million people in the U.S. suffer from some form of reflux. So, Dr. Sheff, thanks for coming on. And I know that the website we're going to use for this is, if people want to learn more, again, it's podcast number 800, but it is Strata, S-T-R-A-T-T-A dash, Strata dash or hyphen therapy. com. So, Dr. Sheff, thanks for coming on. Tell us about GERD.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Mike. It's great to be on with you. GERD, I think there's two statistics I think that'll frame our discussion today. One is that one in three adults in the United States will suffer from gastroesophageal reflux disease, and we can certainly get into what symptoms that causes. But the other important statistic is that 40% of people with GERD don't respond to that purple pill that you discussed. So medications, which are often touted as cure-alls and panaceas, don't work for up to 40% of individuals. And so that's really an unmet need in the GERD therapy, and I think we'll get into that as we go forward.
And in addition, they have some side effects, those purple pills. It's commonly said, don't take them for more than 2 weeks because of the side effects, but people take them forever. And if you listen to that comedian who's a spokesperson on TV, it is, in fact, one, you don't take your medical advice from a comedian on TV. That's one thing. But two is, if you do, remember there's some important warnings, such as don't use it for more than 2 weeks because of some of the side effects.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, certainly these medications work for a lot of individuals, and you can take it. And some people, frankly, need to take it for years, especially if they have very severe symptoms. But I think the problem you're touching on is that these medicines, four of them now, are over-the-counter. And so people can just sort of medicate themselves and do that indefinitely. And that's not what we want to have happen, because recent reports suggest that things like bone health in women can suffer, kidney damage can occur if you take this for many years. And then a recent report, which we still don't know the real answer to, is that there's been actually a link between proton pump inhibitors, these acid blockers, and things like dementia. So I don't think the jury is out on that, but the point is, if you're taking these medications and you feel great for 2 weeks, you should try to stop it. If your symptoms come back, you should see your physician and really figure out whether you need the medications, whether you have GERD, whether you have something else before you start taking these medicines on a daily basis.
And lifestyle choices make a big difference too, right? I mean, isn't this caused by both the type of food you eat and the amount of food you eat and whether you're overweight?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think we don't often talk about this because, frankly, let's face it, it's easier just to take a pill every day. But there are certain trigger foods. The usual culprits are all things that we enjoy, caffeine, alcohol, spicy foods, tomato-based sauces, citrus fruits. All these foods can trigger, and different people will have different triggers. So it doesn't mean that you have to give up coffee, that cup of coffee in the morning completely, but maybe if you're having 3, 4, or 5 cups of coffee a day, maybe you cut back a little bit and that will take away your symptoms. The other big thing I see in my patients is that patients, you know, look, we all lead busy lives. We all work. We come home late. Often we eat dinner very late, and then very shortly thereafter we go to bed. And that's the biggest risk factor for reflux and esophagitis, which is inflammation in the esophagus, is eating a large meal, say, at 8:30, 9 o'clock, and then going to bed at 10, 10:30, not allowing the time for food to digest. That really is one of the big things I see in my patients in terms of triggers for reflux. So sometimes, you know, modifying your diet, exercising more, losing weight, these things can actually take care of your symptoms without needing to take medications.
It used to be, I guess, in Europe, we would have the biggest meal at breakfast and then a smaller meal at lunch and a smallest meal at dinner, which is probably the right way of doing it for preventing GERD. I don't know if they still do that way in Europe anymore, but we clearly don't in America. So that lifestyle change is an important one. Go ahead. What now? So say that it doesn't get relieved by the lifestyle changes, or that you want to do something until those lifestyle changes kick in. What should we be doing?
Right. So I think, let's face it, if you have reflux that just comes and goes, you can take a medicine, an antacid every now and then. I think that, you know, that's probably all you need to do. But if you have patients that really fit into one of two categories, one is somebody who really can't come off the medications, who's taking these medicines, these acid blockers, feeling better, but wants to come off them because of the potential side effects. Or if you have some people that get some relief from the medications, but they're not 100% cured, before the last handful of years, the only options for these patients would be to go on to major surgery. Major surgery, a couple days in the hospital, a week or two of being home from work, modified diet for 6 months, a lot of side effects, a lot of complications. And so patients would say, look, I'm not going to go down that road. But now we have this therapy that you led off with here called Streta therapy. This is an endoscopic treatment, which means it's an outpatient procedure. It takes about 30 to 40 minutes. Nothing is implanted, nothing is left in place, nothing is stitched, the anatomy is not changed. The only thing that's done is small electrodes are actually placed at the valve in the bottom of the esophagus. This valve is called the lower esophageal sphincter. And in people who have reflux, the sphincter, like other muscles, can become weakened. By stimulating this valve at the endoscopy, we can actually work to remodel the valve. So what happens is you have that 30, 40-minute procedure. The valve is stimulated. Again, nothing is left in place. Patients go home. They remain on medications for at least a few months. It does take about 3, 6, 9 months for that valve to remodel and become stronger. And then a lot of patients, a majority of patients actually, are able to come off their medications. Very few side effects, good long-term results. And it's really a new and exciting option for individuals who say, look, I don't want to take medications, but I also don't want to go through major surgery.
So one of the problems with gastroesophageal reflux disease, this reflux esophagitis, essentially the stomach acid and the bile acids refluxing into your esophagus, is it burns the esophagus, and over time that has a risk for what we call Barrett's esophagitis, a severe dysfunction, if you will, or burn of the esophagus. And some of those will develop into cancer as they're remodeled over time. And so one of the problems we want to avoid is that one. And what you're telling us is that by strengthening that muscle at the bottom of the junction between the esophagus and the stomach, so preventing that reflux by strengthening it can prevent the whole process. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, it really helped. Right now, we've shown that it's helped to prevent recurrence of symptoms, and it gets people off their medication. We don't know for sure that it prevents Barrett's esophagus. That's going to take more long-term studies. But I think we can maybe talk a little bit later about Barrett's esophagus, because that is an important distinction in people who have reflux that puts them into a more severe and significant risk category. And we do manage them a little bit differently.
When we come back from these messages, that's exactly what we'll talk about, Barrett's esophagus and what Streta, S-T-R-E-T-T-A .therapy.com, Streta-therapy.com can mean for you. We'll be right back with Dr. Sheff.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Michael Roizen, MD.
RadioMD.com.
Here's Dr. Mike.
And I'm sorry I cut in too early there. Dr. Anish Sheth, S-H-E-T-H, is a gastroenterologist. That's a physician who specializes in gastroenterology, GI issues, issues involving your food tract and food processing tract at the Princeton Medical Group in New Jersey. He received his AB degree from Brown University, his medical degree there, and he got it from the prestigious Hospital University of Pennsylvania, is where he did his residency training, and then went back to Yale, joined the faculty at Yale, and for 5 years has been with the Princeton Medical Group, and now has helped use this new technique, Streta, S-T-R-E-T-T-A, -therapy.com, which apparently stimulates the lower esophageal sphincter, that is the musculature that prevents food from going from your stomach back up into your esophagus, and strengthens that so that you can recover from GERD. So we've been talking a little bit about that. We said we would talk about what Barrett's esophagus is and why that's so important and why strengthening your muscle and preventing long-term heartburn is so important. So Dr. Sheth, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Now tell us about what is Barrett's esophagus.
Yeah, Barrett's esophagus is a cellular change. The lining of the esophagus changes in individuals, in some individuals who've had long-standing reflux disease. So one of the concerns, I had alluded to this sort of phenomenon of individuals just taking over-the-counter medications that control their symptoms. One of the concerns that physicians like me have is that people tend to feel pretty good at times on the medications, but they don't seek physician advice, and they may not get screened for this condition. So Barrett's esophagus is precancerous. It does increase your risk of esophageal cancer, but there are no specific symptoms of it. And so what we want to do is take individuals who have had long-standing heartburn, who've been on medications maybe, and actually do something called an upper endoscopy to actually look at the esophageal lining, to take some samples, and to help diagnose this precancerous condition called Barrett's esophagus.
Now, what percent of people, so if you're saying, is it 3 years if you've had GERD? Is it 1 year of recurrent symptoms? How long do you have to have that before you would say it's indicated to have a upper GI endoscopy, that is a scope put in through your mouth or nose into your esophagus?
Yeah, I think the best time to have this discussion, the age-old rule is about a decade's worth of reflux. But let's face it, people can get Barrett's with just a few years of reflux. What we tend to advocate is that, you know, we're all very familiar with the guidelines to get a screening colonoscopy to screen for colon cancer at age 50. And so what I would encourage individuals to do is to discuss with their gastroenterologist at that time if they've had some degree of reflux chronically. It's a very easy procedure to do at the same time. Patients are already fasting. They're already sedated. It's an easy 5-minute check that really makes sense to do right around that same age, around 50, again, for people who have risk factors for Barrett's esophagus.
So around age 50 and then maybe every 10 years of symptoms after that is what you should look for. Now, the other issue is, how frequently does that turn into a cancer? Is it 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000? How common is this? And is it totally preventable once you know about it?
Yeah, it's a great point. The answer to your second question first. So there is a new tech. There's a relatively new treatment for Barrett's esophagus, which is also endoscopic in nature. So yes, it is. Once we diagnose Barrett's esophagus, we watch people closely. And then if they reach and they start to progress towards cancer, we can actually ablate the abnormal cells. Just like taking out a polyp in the colon prevents colon cancer, we can actually kill off the precancerous cells with an endoscopic procedure to prevent esophageal cancer. And the risk of cancer depends on a lot of things, but on average, we usually say if you have Barrett's esophagus and say you're around 50 years old, the lifetime risk of esophageal cancer is probably somewhere around 8 to 10%. If, again, that's if nothing is done. If the patient doesn't undergo screening, doesn't undergo therapy at all, it's about a 8 to 10% risk lifelong of cancer.
And so when, and so this is really the serious part of heartburn. That is, there are two serious parts of heartburn. One is you use your stem cells up needlessly in repairing it, so they aren't there to repair if you have a heart attack or stroke or need stem cells someplace else in the body. And two is that the second component of it is that it proposes to the risk of cancer. And in addition to, obviously, it gives you, is there a risk, and I guess I don't know the answer to this, is there a risk of lung damage and aspiration if you constantly have sore throats or when you wake up and feel that bile in your throat? Is there a risk of, yeah, of it getting in your lung?
Yeah, there's two sort of scenarios where that becomes important. One is in somebody with reflux at night. So reflux while we're sleeping is particularly dangerous. Because we're asleep, we don't have gravity working for us because we're not in an upright position. And frankly, if we're sleeping and acid is coming back into our throats, we can have what we call aspiration, where that acid and other things are actually going into the lungs and we're not aware. If that happens long enough, people can actually develop lung damage, they can develop scarring, they can actually develop asthma. People who have asthma that's difficult to control, sometimes the reason their asthma is difficult to control is because they're having reflux. As we get older, so elderly patients, patients who have difficulty with protection of their airway, where the muscles in the back of their throat may become weak, are especially at risk for something called aspiration pneumonia. And that's, again, where things and contents from the stomach will come back into the esophagus and then go and end up into the lungs. And that's a big issue for some individuals as we get older, and that's a particularly serious issue with infections, the need for hospitalizations, and antibiotics.
So that gives you the indications, if you have heartburn and reflux esophagitis and even that bile feeling in the morning, and there are a lot of symptoms of heartburn and gastroesophageal reflux disease, this is a serious issue both from its potential to cause cancer and its potential to cause lung problems, even asthma, as you heard. It's a reason to talk to your physician about this new therapy, Streta, S-T-R-E-T-T-A. So you can find more information, streta-therapy.com on the website. Thanks, Dr. Seth from the Princeton Medical Group, gastroenterologist. And I want to thank Ben for great engineering again on You, the Owner's Manual radio show. And I got to thank our executive producer, Donna Gould, who lines up these guests, and they're so outstanding guests. So thank you, and especially thank you, the listener, for downloading the podcast. 49,000 of you are downloading it every week. And thank you very much. We'll be back next week with another live show and two wonderful guests.